Hello, you are listening to or watching the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening or watching. I'm your host, Neil Horowitz. You can hit me up on Twitter, NJ27, also on LinkedIn. The website you can find everything is dsmsports.net, and this podcast is available on whichever podcast platform is your preferred one. Really, really awesome show for you guys today. I really enjoyed this guest. Such a compelling conversation. My guest on the podcast you're going to hear from is Paul Stafford. He is the CEO of Further, design and branding creative agency. They do so much cool work. We got to talk about their work with the Premier League on rebranding the Premier League, about some of the OG work he did with Airbnb. Just tremendous insight into what it means to build a brand, what goes into deciding on a rebrand, all the things to take into account, what the stakeholders are at site when it comes to rebranding. Just really interesting conversation. So here he is, listening up to my tremendous chat with Paul Stafford of Further. I am back on the podcast with today's guest. I'm so psyched to be speaking to him. If it's as good as the kind of the offline conversation, we're gonna have a great chat today. My guest on the podcast today is Paul Stafford. He is the CEO and co-founder of Further. And Paul, welcome to the podcast today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Well, you guys do such good work at Further. Work with some really impressive brands, and germane to this conversation, to do some great work in the sports space as well. So before we get into the meat of our discussion, though, tell us certainly about you, your background, your career path, your stops along the way, and certainly tell us about what you're doing today with Further and the type of work you guys do.
Yeah, well, I guess, well, my background depends how far you go back. I think I've always been in the sort of I've always been in the creative space. I think it was the only thing that really kept my attention, and I think my attention's been a sort of fundamental part of why I've created what I've created. I think I was, I could spend hours of every day sort of on those creative projects, and then when I had to sit through a normal lesson where it was sort of like reciting texts and taking notes, I just found like my ability to sort of concentrate was just gone. And I think when I think about that, it's quite a good foundation for what I do, right? We help businesses that are very good at articulating huge amounts of corporate strategy and exactly what it means for their product and sort of like their roadmap over the next 5 years, and we help them turn it into something that actually I think connects with their customers, connects with their employees, and helps them sort of articulate their difference in a marketplace. And when you think about that, that's exactly what my problem was, right? I'm good at distilling information, turning it into something quite compelling that people are going to find interesting, that communicates what we're trying to do, but actually resonates with people. And I think that's really what led me into this specific part of creative kind of work, because I do love the craft, I do love the design part, but I also love like helping kind of like create strategic understanding and building businesses, and that's exactly what we do.
So
And so I
tell
think
me about how the career path.
sorry.
Yeah, tell me like how that played out as you figured out what your job was going to be.
Yeah, well, I guess what happened was that then, I went into design and graphic design, which is very much about the application of kind of like creating identities, etc. I think I then moved down to London, where actually a couple of tutors from my university course hired me. And I actually had a few offers at that time, but the reason I wanted to go with them was they were a small business. There were only two of them, and I was number three. And I was like, what excited me about that was building a business, being part of something, hoping it was going to grow and being a fundamental component of that. And I love the fact that I wasn't just doing the design. I was kind of doing the client servicing. I was doing the invoicing. I was like doing all of the changes. I was also understanding like how it was affecting the bottom line. So even at that stage, I was learning about the business side of things. And I realized there wasn't one half of that I wanted to lose. I enjoyed all of it. I think what I also realized is that I went and worked at some big agencies. I worked at boutique agencies, and I think, I recognized that I didn't find somewhere that I felt was doing it perfectly or right. I felt like businesses were set up in a kind of blueprint that was created 30 years ago, and they were still rolling out that process. And I think modern businesses, like the likes that we started working with, were looking for something different. And that was that they wanted a partner. They didn't just want an agency. They wanted someone that collaborated with them. They didn't want to work with a strategist team and then kind of like cut them off and then work with a creative team. They wanted to blend this all together. They wanted people that really understood their businesses and became partners to them to help develop their kind of brands and their strategies. And so we set up 2009, we set up Design Studio, which was really that, a couple of guys trying to challenge the sort of like huge agencies and the dinosaurs. And start getting themselves on the pitch rosters against them. And it took a long time, but you know, we needed like a big client to buy into that, and we can talk about that. I think Airbnb were the first guys that sort of realized that we had something. Well,
client.
yeah, but you know, I didn't know them at the time. They were quite small, but
Yeah,
actually,
that's
it needed someone with like the ambition of their founders to take that leap and that risk on us, you know, because they saw that we were exciting. They saw that we were going to work in a way that really resonated with them. They didn't see 20 years worth of work of doing it before for other clients, but
right.
they didn't care. They were like, we don't care. These are the guys to do it. They're like us in this space. And I think what that did was obviously catapulted us onto the sort of like, you know, Airbnb became this incredible story, this incredible brand, and we were a big component of it, that it proved that we could do it. It proved that our model worked, and that elevated up to be on those pitch lists.
Yeah, and what does the organization or the business look like today? Like, are you working with startups like Airbnb? Like, not that Airbnb is a startup anymore, really. But like, what verticals? I know we'll touch on the sports side in particular with this podcast. But consumer brands, B2B brands, startups, tech. Like, give us an idea of what your perspective looks like today.
Yeah, so I think the thing I've always been proud of with Historic Design Studio, and I'll talk a little bit why we've changed to further now, is that we were working with the brands that I felt like make up part of modern culture. That's always what I wanted to do. I didn't really want to work on stuff that was hidden, squirreling away in the background on some R&D projects that never saw the light of day. I wanted stuff that millions of people were going to interact with. And what I'm so proud about is when people quite often ask me about my clients, I'll say, well, open your phone, because I can guarantee there'll probably be like five, six, or seven of our brands sitting there right now. And I was like, and actually, when you walk out the door, you're bound to bump into four or five of our brands just walking down the streets. And I think they're the type of businesses I want to work with. Now, scale doesn't matter. I don't think it matters. I think we work with now big, very established businesses that make up part of that modern culture. But I also love working with those businesses that I believe are going to be the next generation of those businesses. You know, we're working with a few sports brands and some clothing brands that you can tell they are breaking into being part of like modern culture. And so it's not about the scale, it's more about the ambition and where I believe they're going to play. And so historically, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to get on those pitch lists. But really, the shift to further recently was to really, you know, service those brands in bigger, more meaningful ways. So we moved to further because actually we want to move out. These brands now don't just need graphic design strategy. They're living in broadcast worlds and digital worlds and motion spaces and physical environments. And I think what our clients started asking was for, once we started working with them, was like, can you help us in these different places? So recently we went on a bit of a M&A journey to bring businesses in to actually now offer clients the ability to not just work on strategy and brand identity, but actually their digital products, their broadcast guidelines, their physical spaces, and offer it at those same levels. So that's recently why we made the big decision to shift from what was Design Studio. We've outgrown it. It's not just focused on design. We're now much bigger, and we help businesses in more compelling ways, which was part of the shift to further.
Heck yeah. And when you think about like the evolution of what brand represents, and I mean, even going back to when you first started Design Studio in 2009 to where we are today, and all the different touch points that people have with brands, let alone the global nature of brands that, like, if you are a big brand now, especially some of the brands that you work with, that you are going to encounter fans in very different cultures, very different parts of the world, very different platforms. So I guess, like, what have you seen that evolution affect the way that you have to think about the I guess brand manifestation, and where some of us, I guess, you might think like, oh yeah, it's just what people what your Instagram aesthetic looks like or what your website looks like, or but it's every single touch point you may have, and sometimes even the stuff that people may not see quite as visibly. It's the stuff on the back of the box or whatever it might be. So like, when you think about what brand represents and what a brand strategy looks like that's fully integrated, what comes to mind? How has that evolved in your time?
Yeah, it is a massive misconception. I think it's part of the problem of our world of not being brilliant at articulating like it, because it is so broad and so big that it is so difficult to say, oh yeah, it's this bit and this bit and this bit. And I think, you know, my parents still don't quite understand what I do. But you know, I think it has changed, but only on a fundamental sort of like, I guess, you know, where brands show up has changed. But actually, fundamentally, what lies at the core hasn't changed ever. And I think that is where the hardest work is done. And that's where the real focus needs to be. And that is really helping a brand articulate its mission and its vision to the world. You know, I think many businesses are good at sort of distilling a business strategy and understanding what they're trying to do on a tangible level of like, yeah, we're going to invest in this space, we're going to develop this product, so we're going to appeal to these target audiences. But actually, you know, you can't then just communicate that to the world. You need to sort of understand, well, what does that mean? And how does that translate into a role that this business is going to play in their customers' lives? You know, what is it that the, you know, Jeff Bezos famously said, you know, a brand is what people say about you when they're not in the room. And that's exactly it. What are they going to say about you? So really, it's that piece which becomes like sacred. It has to be this mission that everyone within the business understands, and they understand how they're going to articulate it, and that's through every part of the business. So yes, how will that change how someone, you know, sees my product and how they interact with it? How does that change how our employees are actually dealt with? What is our employee value proposition? How does that change what our marketing communication is going to see through our advertising? You know, and it's not just those big ticket items, it's every single interaction that any customer, any employee, anybody, any business has with your business should really kind of play through that lens of like, well, how does it build on that proposition? How is it uniquely a relationship and an experience that only our business could have? And I think that's it. You know, you should be able to cover the logo, cover the kind of marketing copy, but the whole experience and interaction should feel very much like that brand. And so it doesn't really matter about what the touch points are. You know, they can grow and will continue to grow, especially in this world of AI, but actually that proposition should stay sacred from the very beginning, right the way through to the very end.
And is that multifaceted nature of the way that people encounter the brand affect how you have like? Is it so important to be super consistent across, like, whether I only encounter the brand through their mobile app, or only encounter the brand through attending a game, or only encounter the brand if I think back to, like, when I was a kid, even like whatever you saw on the TV commercial, it might be the only way that you see what the brand is trying to stand for and what they're trying to represent. Like, is are we trying to create something that is everything to everyone and everywhere they encounter the brand? Or are there sort of like, this is how the brand is going to show up in this medium, this is how the brand is going to show up in this medium? Yes, there's something of a consistent through line, but there are, you know, subtle differences, and that's okay. That's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, there should be differences, but the core proposition should stay the same, but it should be translated differently. And I think that's hugely important. And I think it's better to put it in that tangible way. I mean, it shouldn't just be, and I keep talking about the big ticket items, like, oh, here's how we show up in advertising in Western markets. Here's how we show up in the sort of China market. It's not just those big things. Really, what you want to do is build a proposition, which is this is what our company stands for. This is why we're different. And this is what we're trying to achieve over the next 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, doesn't matter. This is what we're aiming to be, and this is the role we play in their lives. Once the teams understand that, it's then their role to understand, well, how do we nuance that for what I'm trying to do? And it might be if I'm trying to, I guess, communicate with this certain customer, how am I going to nuance and play what I need to do and the way I need to communicate, and that kind of ladders back to that proposition. So really, it is all about nuances, but the core fundamental part of it should stay the same and should never shift, because ultimately, if you're changing what you stand for, the role you play, then you become this brand that no one fully understands. You've got to kind of reiterate that message through every single interaction, big or small. And the best brands in the world, that's exactly what they do.
In like a micro sense, I almost think of it as like the businesses or brands that try to just keep up with the trends and the algorithm, and try to just like feed the internet rather than doing what they're good at, or what they're best at, or what they should be doing. It's just following along, tailing, instead of like doing something original and being themselves, I guess, and not being afraid to be themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's it now, especially, you know, right in this world of AI where brands can make so much. You know, I can shift a piece of communications to you and make it different for me, and I can do it really quickly using these tools. It's just going to get harder and harder to cut through. But the best brands in the world will realize that they have this role, they know where the space that they play, and it will make sure that they find the most amazing ways of communicating that to their customers. And there'll be a curated journey. You know, that's how you create cut through, is by using creativity to think about how you curate these moments to be amazing, completely different, and always ladder back to that proposition that means they're uniquely you. And those are the brands that ultimately will win.
So I want to like deep dive into that a bit, and especially speaking from the sports perspective, because I do think that sports organizations are unique and diverse in that their product is, yes, they are putting on entertainment and they want you to engage with their media, but they're not like A, they're not trying to pretend like they're making the world a better place, although in some ways they are with community development and all that good stuff. And they're not necessarily trying to, sell you a widget. I mean, in some cases they are too with merch. But also, like, they're thinking about they are trying to attract corporate partners. They want to be attractive to that audience. They're trying to attract everyone from the diehards who are going to eat, sleep, and breathe everything they do, while also attracting new fans and casuals and inviting them to be this brand that they can come and love as well. So, like, how do you think about trying to all these not necessarily competing incentives, but different parties, different perspectives, and trying to be everything to everyone and wanting to have that, like, FOMO or that aspirational brand that everyone wants to be a part of, while also making sure that you're catering to what's going to bring in new fans, what's going to keep our old fans happy, what's going to attract a premium audience, what's going to attract a non-premium audience, what's going to attract a sponsor audience. And I'm going to stop rambling now because there's so much here to consider. I want to get your perspective on
Yeah, it's a big question. I think
it, Paul.
it's not, I mean, it's the same for sports brands as it is for anyone else. And I think one of the most amazing tools and people I worked alongside actually who introduced me to this tool was a guy called Douglas Aitken. And he'd studied communities and he studied everything from tribes in kind of remote parts of the world through to bees, through to sort of huge businesses and why people followed them, through to those super brands that had like these diehard communities and sports teams. And I think he didn't then think about, well, how do we kind of like, are we appealing to some of these or just one of these? He actually thought about them on what he called the commitment curve and how he was going to kind of like bring everyone from the most engaged fans right the way down to people who'd never heard of the business or never heard of the club before on the journey. And I think I've used that a lot when we're creating brands. I think once you've got that proposition, it's about how do we communicate it to each of those different levels of people and how committed they are. So if you think about this as a sort of chart, and you think about it as like, who's the most committed on this side, and also then how much you can ask those people who are committed that much, what's the ask, the size of the ask. So if you think about it as a founder or a chairman or the team, right? It's like those people are the most committed to the business and you can make the biggest ask of them. You don't need to sell them anything. They are the business, right? And I guess then you can think about each of these kind of parts of the community is like a step down. So the next step down will be your employees or the actual team players in there, right? You can almost ask them the same. Next down, you've probably got your most avid fans and supporters. Next down, you just kind of like turn up, yeah, I go 3, 4 times a year kind of fans, but I am monitoring. All the way through to people that have never heard of you. And I think when you're generating a brand, what you need to think of is like, well, how do we give the assets to each of these people to make them take one step up that ladder? So what do we give our employees or our team? What tools do we give them so they start acting like founders? They start acting like CEOs. They know the decisions to make. They know how to communicate what this business means as a founder. Those super fans, how do we give them the tools they need to start talking about us like they play for the club? Like, how do we give them that? And all the way down, how do we give those people then who've never heard of the club just the tools to kind of take that one step up to like, okay, I get it. I get what they stand for. They play a different role. I'm kind of interested. And that's the way we've done it. The whole process is over time to help those people take one step up that ladder. And it's a really good way of thinking about teams or businesses of like, how do you engage all those different parts of community and then think about the tools you need just to help them on an individual basis. And I think, again, a lot of the most successful brands understand that. They don't target one or the other. They target all of them, but in specific ways.
No, I like that framework for sure, and it makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I'm almost anxious to hear, like, do you every brand that you guys work with, and I'm thinking about, you mentioned Airbnb, obviously. We talk about some of the sports brands, we talk about some of the other big name brands, like you mentioned, some of the mainstream that you work with. Like, are you essentially just trying to, is it possible for every business to have fans? Like, is that the goal? Is that
It is.
any business, where you could be an exterminating company that kills termites and you can still have fans of your brand?
Yeah, 100%, right? And I think even if you're saying fans of the brand, it's like people to make a choice over others and pick you, right? That's what you're aiming for them to do. And I think you're right. It's the problem with brand is it is different to marketing in terms of advertising because you can directly track how an ad has sort of like shifted someone or driven traffic to something, right? Brand touches every part of the business, and it's a sort of strategy and a sentiment that underpins everything, but doesn't actually deliver like a direct like this brand had this moment where people then were driven to the website. It's like a long-term thing that you need to track, and I think we have been trying to shift. What are the metrics that you can track it? And I think that's right. That's why it works for sports clubs and businesses because I think the things you can track are actually, it is fandom. It's like, are people fans of this business? Will they show up to things and support this business over another one? Are they advocates of a business? Will they, as you will do in the kind of pubs or wherever, talk about your team, enthuse about them, why my team is better than your team? Can we build that advocacy? And then the final, and I think the, if you can achieve this, the sort of like most grand metric is when you're so kind of connected to a brand, you love the brand. You almost, you know, it's that. It's such a huge commitment to something that you'll almost go out of your way to do something for that brand. And I think you'll see that in sports possibly more than any other business, right? Is that diehard fans will love the brand. They'll literally say that. They'll put the club ahead of their wife and kids, right? It's like ultimately it's the same thing with businesses. You're trying to build that strength of connection. And in a way, they're the metrics that you need to sort of track.
Yeah, I think you hit on like such a key point there around the value of brand marketing. And it feels like we go in these like roller coasters, and I'm making a pantomiming with my hand now for people that are just listening. Of sometimes like brand marketing is really important, and let's do it, and let's invest in it. Long-term value, lifetime value, and creating advocates for life and customers for life. And then we see dips, and it's like, no, wait, we need to make sure we're getting bang for our buck. Like let's direct response. Show me the like the short-term value. What's this spend making me tomorrow? And we go back to brand, and it feels like we're in a bit of a spike now back toward the value of brand marketing, and I think AI is only going to continue to increase that. So when you're thinking about like I guess when I'm business too, is thinking about making an investment in brand or deciding to rebrand, like what are the motivations behind that? What you mentioned some of the ways that they measure, like whether it's lifetime value, how feasible is that to measure? Advocacy, are they using like surveys or NPS scores, or like what's the nitty-gritty of that? And pricing and elasticity, whatever it might be, like what are some of the ways that they're justifying brand spend and then measuring both the short-term value but also really the long-term value, and how they justify those investments to the higher ups?
Yeah, well, that's what, it is difficult. It is difficult to kind of like really put like, okay, here's the ROI on that, and it is a long-term play. But I think, as you say, the world's sort of waking up to recognizing that the winners at the moment are those people that have, yes, not creating these marketing campaigns that almost feel like a completely different business each time they're launched, or because oh, this is cool right now. Let's go into that route, and then we completely change our story and our tack now. It's hard to sort of really build long-term advocacy when something's changing the, I guess, what it's communicating each time it has a different campaign. And I think what brands are realizing is that long-term value is that each time a campaign is launched, it really builds on the story, and it builds a clearer and clearer and clearer picture in your head of why you should associate with this brand and why you should pick this brand over the other. I think there are certain moments where businesses need to do it. I think if you think about it really, when a brand new business is launched and it has no identity and it has no understanding of what it's doing, of course, a startup, there is a time there where there needs to be an investment. But I think, the investment at that stage is really probably just trying to communicate what you're doing now and introduce something to the market. Give people an understanding of what you are, why you exist. So normally that's the first time I think people look to invest in their brand is right at the beginning, or just as soon as there's a product to take to
Yeah,
market.
we think about like when expansion teams come along in sports, like that's what comes to mind immediately.
Yeah, and I think, okay, perfect, you're launching it. I think the next time that investment, and then it is a more sizable investment, is quite often what happens is you build scale, you have competition. Okay, so now the world understands what we do, but three or four or five or 100 of us are saying very similar things. So now we need to invest in understanding, well, why are we different to anyone else? And how do we kind of make sure people clearly understand that? And how do we change all of our products and our communications so that people recognize that and pick us over the rest? And then I think the next phase is when you get even bigger scale, is you start diversifying products, right? There'll be extra things that you start investing in. There will be new product lines or different sectors that we move into. All of a sudden, you're almost starting again. We need to introduce those to the world, and we also need to understand our kind of customers to understand, well, why have we moved into this, and why does this bigger thing make sense? So these are generally the kind of moments where I think it's like right to invest in brand. And you kind of like really get these peaks and troughs. It's like, okay, there's a big piece of noise, we'll get a huge growth, and then you see it tailing off, and it's generally where that next phase is kind of like, coming in. It's competition or new products that are dipping in.
No, I love that because I'm thinking about how you're seeing the sports organizations that have strong brands almost like have permission to go into other more novel areas. Like They can do a merch collaboration. They can do a even like I think recently did like a mobile plan in college athletics. Auburn has a mobile plan now that their fans can get, or you can create a whatever a branded gym or a branded beer line, whatever it might be. So it almost gives you permission to do more when you have that ability to have that strong brand and people like you for who you are, as opposed to just like because of some other association, I guess. So when you look at like. When I'm thinking about a sports organization perspective, and we are trying to like, I think a lot of sports teams start out as whether it's generational or modern, they're building off of their local fan base. So this is what our city's all about. This is what we're all about. But then you also see some brands that are trying to become more global, and they're trying to appeal or at least create something that anyone in any part of the world can relate to. And I think about some of the Premier League clubs who are like, this is what Man City is all about. And whether you are in Nepal, or you're in Brazil, or you're in the States, or you're in the UK, this is what can drive you to that team. So I guess I say all this to say, like, when you're thinking about the different ways that brand manifests, like we think about PSG and luxury, think about whatever a blue collar team and hard work, or we think about history and like, or we think about even like the way that the tone of voice on their social media, or the aesthetics that they have on their content, or how they speak, or how their executives speak. Like, what are all the when we're looking at evaluating what this organization, what this business brand is, what are some of those things that you look at to say, this is what your brand is saying to the public now? No matter what you're saying internally, this is what's coming off, and this is how it's being manifest, this is how it's being exposed, and this is the leverage you can pull to adjust that if you want.
Yeah, well, I guess that's part of the process, and I think this is why it's important as well, I think, to do this with external agencies over trying to do this internally. And it's also important to sort of have a business that knows how to run the process, where to listen, where to push back. Because I think you're right. Going back to what I talked earlier about that commitment curve, again, it's like you don't want to leap across a couple of people and therefore leave those engaged fans or those original people behind because you're too focused on the future. So we really start with this immersion phase where I coined a phrase to try and like really just put it into my team. It's like we know nothing. If we've rebranded 50 kind of football teams in the past, it doesn't matter. If we're doing it again, forget everything and learn because every challenge has to be unique. So we will go out and we'll grab all of the quantitative data, we'll interview the fans, we'll talk to all of the teams, we'll understand the challenges with what they're doing currently, we'll understand where they're trying to get to in the future, and then we'll come back with huge amounts of information and try and distill those truths out of it. Like, what is it that we hear again and again that's uniquely this club over another that we can own? And actually, it's going to give us a real platform that we can take forward to understand what we're going to do in the future. And you're right, that's where we'll understand these things. Is this a sports club that's like based off hundreds of years of innovation? Is this someone that's like actually really entrenched in an industrial part of the city that doesn't want to lose that sort of grittiness that they had from their kind of like founding roots? And so therefore, we'll get these values and these components and understand, okay, well, how do we kind of maintain these and build a proposition that sort of like makes sense of this, but also points us in a direction that aligns with where we're trying to get to in the future. And that really will be distilled down into what I say will be the proposition and values of this business. Because I think that's the danger, right? If your club wants to move into all of these new spaces and forgets its loyal fans, forgets its roots, you sort of like lose that connection. And like I'm saying, you actually, a brand is never successful by just its own internal teams communicating. You need those advocates. You need those fans to go and tell that story for you. So you need to take them on the journey. And that's why really you have to sort of like understand what it is that's important to them, how that becomes a foundation, and how it communicates where you're going in the future. And lots of people get that wrong.
Totally.
Because it all comes from as well. You do want to hold a mirror up to the club and sort of like decipher what makes them special, but you have got to remember how important it is about where they're going as well, right? A fan will undoubtedly tell you about the history and about the past, but they're not too interested in the future. It's what's important to them. And I think if you listen too much, you build something that's not scalable, that doesn't kind of like drive for this kind of vision of the future, and is actually just a looking backwards brand. And also, quite often, fans don't really know what they want. I don't know if you saw the Leeds United piece before. They went and just interviewed the fans and listened to everything they said, and then created something that is exactly what the fans said, but then when they had it played back to them, it was wrong. And I think that's right. You've got to understand where you listen, where you challenge and where you kind of have to take fans on a journey to the future, even if they don't like it at the beginning. So how are you going to take them on the journey?
Great insight. When you are both having these conversations, whether that is interviewing fans directly or just understanding the feedback once things start to play out, or speaking internally or doing surveys, like what are the main, I guess, surface area touch points that do affect fans' perception or customers' perception, as it may be, of brand? Is it like the actual process of, like, if you're thinking about an Airbnb, is it the checkout process? Is it the way that their, like, emails come back and the way that the tone sounds? Is it the aesthetics? Is it, going to a game in person and what that experience is like? What are the things that if you were to say this tends to have the most impactful effect on someone's, on a fan or a customer's perception of the brand, like what are those areas that are front facing that are the most impactful, especially early on when you're trying to really make it out there? I imagine it's not just a press release from the CEO.
No, so it's fairly clear, and I think if you look historically at where brands have, and it goes right back to that first question of, like, the misunderstanding of what brand is. The points that always have the most focus, get the most pushback, is always the visual elements, and it's the things that they recognize, because these are the symbols that stand for their clubs or stand for their businesses, and when you change them, you better have a good reason for changing it, because that is the biggest focal point. So when we launched Premier League, when we launched Airbnb, part of that process was even educating their teams on there will be huge amounts of negativity around this when you launch it. We've been on the process. We know why this is right. We know why these things need to change. We need to stand behind this, and we need to create tools that educate our fans, our community, on why we've made these changes. But they will hate it day one, because it's just that change people find uncomfortable. And so really, yeah, the language will change, the comms will change, maybe even parts of the experience will change, but you'll never get as much pushback as you will on anything that was part of that visual identity changing. So when the Premier League launched, for those that don't know it, really, I guess, it simplified this old lion motif, and really we focused on really the head of the lion, and we got so many kind of like memes and GIFs of decapitating lions, and of Simba being held up in the Lion King. It was just like all of these things, and like people pushing back. But we stuck with it, and we educated people of why this change had happened. And gradually that disappears. And now I think if you see the new brand versus the old brand, you can't imagine that old brand being the sort of identity that sits for the Premier League. It just feels so outdated. It doesn't feel like it represents what the Premier League stands for now, but it's still a journey to kind of take people on that.
And I think if anything, we always say, like, you have to fear apathy and silence as opposed to people being pissed off. People being pissed off is good. That means they care, and that's better than silence, because then it's crickets, and no one gives a shit. So
Yeah, we'll just
yeah.
expect it, I think. Yeah, expect it. I mean, Airbnb even created a tool. So they did the best thing of, like, we did semiotic testing. We sent it out. We got all the feedback. So we knew what some of the commentary was going to be. And then they set up a team that when all these things came in, they had illustrators drawing all of the things that they said. It looks like this. It looks like this. It looks like this. They just really embraced it. And you know what? That noise was like 48 hours. And again, go back and look at the old Airbnb identity compared to where we are now, and it'll be amazing to think that people were challenging us on this shift.
Let's take, I mean, whether it's the Premier League or any other examples of what influenced the decision to say now is the time for a rebrand, like this is a good time to do this now, and then how you take into account those that early feedback to say, like, is it always just say, let it pass, it's gonna be, people are gonna get used to it in a week and it's gonna be even better, they're gonna realize, like, it was better than how it was before, or other times where you do have to pivot or tweak or make changes. Like, what's that journey look like from now's the time to do this to this is the best direction going forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's usually a sort of fundamental moment where a brand needs to do this. So let's take, they're always different. Let's take the Premier League, for example. If you remember the Premier League, oh my God, I can't remember when this was, 2015, 16. Actually, it used to be the Barclays Premier League. And
Yeah,
there,
that's right.
and actually what happened was that the TV rights deal pumped so much money into this that actually the Premier League recognized that, they looked to the American leagues and said, we want to build our own identity and our own moment. We don't want it. At the moment, we're behind Barclays, and people were building sort of this advocacy for Barclays and the Premier League. We want to build like an NBA. We want to build like an NFL. We want to be a brand in our own right. We want to strengthen our commercial partnerships. We can leverage the brand if we build a Premier League brand. So that was the moment they recognized we need to do something here. We need to carve a path away from Barclays, stand on our own, and create a brand that I guess works in more places. You know, it was very corporate. And they recognized that actually this brand needed to work harder. They needed to, yes, they probably needed to still sit at a very corporate level and communicate to big sponsorship deals and partners and broadcast rights. But then they also wanted to have events where they had 5-year-olds having kick-arounds on a Saturday morning and under a Premier League sort of event. You know, how does that brand live in those two spaces? And then they were also pushing out into new mediums like digital channels where this brand just did not fundamentally work anymore. It was so complicated and intricate that actually the new sizes it needed to work at, it just didn't physically work. So, you know, that was a moment where that triggered the need for that project. But each business will be different in what's the trigger of why we need to sort of like invest in this now.
And actually, Paul, if I can step in, like, who's usually driving that? Is that like a is that coming from the C-suite? Is it coming from like a person in comms? Is it coming from a person in marketing and brand? Is there a brand marketing person who's like, now I'm gonna make my job even more important. Let's redo the brand. Like, where's that drive come from?
I think it comes from different places again. Quite often, it always has to be at C-suite level eventually, right?
Yeah,
Because
get that
again,
sign off.
if you're gonna build something that is gonna affect every part of the business and the CEO or the founder is not bought in, it's impossible because you're
Totally.
sort of trying to dictate what the business is doing as a side partner, while the founder's over here saying something else. So ultimately, it has to be there. But where the trigger points are from, it can be from loads of different places. So. Which is why when we're also starting on these processes, we talk to so many parts of the business, not just the marketing teams. You know, often it is a marketing team that recognizes it. But when you think about the Premier League, their broadcast teams were complaining that they had an asset that they couldn't animate, and therefore it was making their jobs impossible to kind of like own footage. Because if we want to own a bit of footage, we've somehow got to animate this full lion. We don't have a stat, it doesn't really work. And actually, they even said to us, when you invert it, which you need to do out of broadcast footage, it turned into this creepy Santa Claus thing. So really, there was like that element. We had legal teams saying that our brand needs to work harder. We've got people like black markets ripping off the sort of Premier League badges that go on sleeves. We need a brand that can actually have more components and more parts of its assets that we can use to make intricate details that mean it's harder to replicate and copy. So it doesn't matter. All over the business, you'll find that there are challenges of why maybe this piece of work needs to happen. But fundamentally, usually it's when there's a strategic change, shift, a need to communicate something else that is usually recognized by the C-suite.
Yeah, no, definitely helps it. Because I'm thinking, trying to put myself in the shoes of someone who's at a business, a team, a league, an organization, and saying like, this brand is stale, and how do we make that change? How does it actually have to? What the seeds are that have to get in place to make that happen, I guess. And
Yeah, and it's you know, it's when they're recognizing market share is becoming hard, where we're being confused with others, or you know, others are eating our lunch, or we're not differentiated. Now there's too many in our marketplace. It goes back to those three sort of moments I kind of picked out before. I think quite often a founder will recognize a need to differentiate or a need to sort of elevate their business beyond the sort of competitive set. And I think that's quite often the trigger.
Just a few minutes left here with Paul Stafford, CEO and co-founder of Further. Just I can geek out on stuff all day, but I won't keep it too much longer. We'll get to our shareable stat segment in just a moment. But I want to talk about you mentioned about this before a little bit of like people responding and different ways the brand plays out a little bit. And so I want to talk about the opportunity of like, I almost think about like Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point of like who's actually like making sure that what you're saying, what the brand is putting out there, what the corporation's putting out there actually seeps through to the consumers, to the end users. And yes, of course, their firsthand experience with the product itself or with the service itself will affect their perception. But thinking about whether it's corporate partners or certainly creators, influencers, third-party media, like how is the increased importance? And I say that like at the expense almost of brand accounts and influencer accounts when it comes to like those touch points with consumers and users on the social media front, as corporations and brands lose exposure. Although it's not maybe not quite as bad as the narrative comes out to be, but it's ultimately people are getting their news from creators. People are getting their opinion from influencers. And so how does that affect the way that you think about, okay, we have to, yes, we like it's great to put out all the press releases and put out stuff on our corporate accounts and all that, but we have to make sure it gets in the hands of people who are actually influencing public opinion and and get people to talk about us behind our back in a good way, in the way that we want them to. Like, how does that play out from an execution perspective?
Yeah, so look, this is the the modern challenge, I think, with brands that sports brands, any brand is going to feel in the future. And we've just been talking with a key sort of like gaming partner about this exact thing, right? It's like modern brands now, well, historically, brands was all about sort of like, I guess, locking something down to be rigid so that every single interaction was not just unique, but almost the same. It's like that was what originally branding was, right? Stamp something so that it is recognizably yours
Yeah.
and every kind of one of them looks the same. And that shifted as we've moved out into different platforms. So like we need some flexibility across that. Now it's at another level. And I think as AI and the influencers and, you know, I guess people wanting to kind of make their own versions of content, how do you embrace that? You know,
Yeah.
don't lock it down. Don't kind of like put water marks across everything so it's your content is always seen as yours. It's like, how are you going to embrace it that's going to allow these content creators to use your brand? But what are you going to do that still gives it that ability to be recognized as you and yours? So it's hugely difficult. We're working a lot with brands now to say, well, we need to stop this being so locked down. We need to give it the flexibility to embrace and utilize the community that they're going to go and use these assets. We just need to build some way that those things, whether that's a visual way, whether it's a tonal way, that kind of resonates and builds it back to us. And you're right, it's difficult because we're going to live in this world of less control. And some of the stuff's not going to be right. We're not going to like it, but ultimately we're going to have to allow people to sort of like utilize our content and take it out there. So
Yeah.
we are working with brands now that hugely on the agenda of like, how do you create assets that can always be kind of like adapted, given out, iterated on, but also be recognized as you and yours and
Yeah.
build that brand loyalty back to you. So it's going to be a bigger and bigger challenge as we go forwards, but it is how brands need to start thinking.
Yeah, totally. We're in that culture of remixing and co-creation and democratization of content, and it's ultimately a good thing, but also it forces brands to make sure they can be flexible and versatile and all that as well. When you think about that, like from again from an execution perspective, like is it like we want to be really proactive in social listening and understand what people are saying about us and then lean into that. Where I think about like Stanley Cups, for example, like when they saw what was happening and they decided, okay, let's lean into this, or like. Alternatively, or equally, you can say, this is the story we want to get out there. Let's seed it, but not necessarily deceptively, but something like that of like, let's put it in the hands of some influencers. Let's try to get this story out there as opposed to being more reactive. Like, is that sort of proactive versus reactive? Social listening versus seeding? Like, how do you see that play out and what kind of tends to work the best?
Well, I think it goes right back to that commitment curve analogy that I gave, right? It's like we're now going to think about these people as part of our business and what are the tools they need to successfully go and do it. The worst thing I think of to do is like try and clamp it down and not allow them to do it. We need to embrace it because, you know, my son, I'd say 90% of the content he gets isn't, you know, he loves the Premier League. He doesn't really watch the Premier League, but he'll watch his kind of like influences, his YouTube shorts that are generating the content from that footage. That kind of appeals to him. That's how he digests it, and I think that's it. It's about okay, well, how do we embrace this? How do we build that proposition so people really understand what we stand for, and so hopefully they become advocates of that and start communicating it. And then how do we enable them to do it? How do we give them the tools to make the content the best it can possibly be, and hopefully kind of like tie back and build that advocacy, fandom, and loyalty back to our business, no matter what they're doing. So it is
Yeah.
about kind of it's about creating, understanding the tools that they need to do this successfully. And I think you will find, yes, 20% of those people are probably going to make something negative that's not there. 80%, if you've done it the right way, will do it as advocates of your business and build stuff that builds equity back for your brand.
Yeah. And ultimately, if it's positive, no matter what story they're telling, it's gonna raise the perception of your brand, I guess, and be a net good at the end of the day. And you mentioned too, a couple times in the interview, Paul, about AI and the onslaught of generative AI. If you're living and breathing on this earth, you have definitely encountered AI somewhere in your life, and certainly in the context of content and brand and all that as well. And, we saw a little bit of Disney freaking out a little bit when Sora first came out and saying, hey, you can't bastardize our brand, and so to speak. And so like, I think it plays right into the sort of conversation that you and I are having right now around being okay with your brand being not usurped is the wrong term, but being adapted and being utilized as a jumping off point. And so as Gen AI becomes more and more just a part of everyday life and a part of every platform, Like, how are you thinking about it from the perspective of your customers, and what you guys are looking to do it further? Is it about saying, let's lean into, like, Gen AI is going to be a part of this. When we put out content, people are going to riff on, people are going to remix it. Let's make sure to help these generative AI tools, or build our own and let people play with our brand and be co-creators with it. Or do you have to be a little more protective and make sure that your brand's not being co-opted in nefarious ways, or by these generative AI tools that are not under your control?
It's again, as it's a difficult question, right, of where this is going and how wide it's going to go and how quickly it's moving. But I think the reality is it's happening and it's going to happen. And that's what I mean. Again, like the previous question, you can't fight it. You have to embrace it. I think there's going to be more and more noise. I think the bigger threat to businesses is actually to understand how people are going to do this. People are going to take that brand. As I said before, you want to hope that you're going to give them the tools that they're going to do it in a positive way that builds equity back for your business. I think what's more important is actually as more and more of this noise comes through, how do you raise your stuff above it? How do you create that cut through? Because everyone's going to be a designer, everyone's going to be a content creator, it's going to be completely commoditized. What are you going to put out into the marketplace that's going to elevate you above it so that people you can still kind of like drive the narrative? And I think really that becomes more on investing less in the tools and more in those creative minds to understand, well, how do we curate a kind of like the moments that sit above this? How do we take some of this content, or how do we find the right people to associate with, or how do we create our own content that actually really builds our brand, really builds a kind of a strong equity on top of what we're doing, and cuts through the noise and builds that narrative that we want to build, because that's going to be what's hard. It's not going to be generating more content. It's going to be generating content that cuts through.
And what are those, especially from a sports angle, those inherent advantages that the brand itself has? Like, we talk about access, or we talk about being able to control narratives, we talk about being able to use IP and use content, or use highlights and whatnot. Like, what are those things that a brand can lean into that in theory, an everyday creator would have to play catch up to a little bit?
Well, yeah, it is. You're a step ahead. I think that's the thing. You know, as a brand, you know where you're going and what you're trying to do, and you should have visibility on the next steps. And I think that's really what you can take out to the world is like less reflecting on what you've been doing and past glories, and more about what this business and what this sports company is trying to do in the future and where we're going, right? And I think potentially that's where the more investment needs to be. We're going to have millions of people be able to tell our story for us potentially, and especially we maybe want to engage with the ones that we feel are doing it in the best way, and let them take care of creating content that resonates with our audiences that we want to do. And actually, we need to create the stories that cut through to kind of show the bigger ambition of what we're trying to do as a business, as a team, as a club, and kind of like show the future. Like the here's an amazing amount of content that's out there in the world that people are re-editing, recutting. That's our last 100 years of glories. But only we really know of what we're trying to do over the next 100 years. And I think that's what's important to fans and communities as well, is that inside access that only the businesses and the brands can have.
I like that a lot. And we talk a lot about, like, proactive planning, and also, like, to your point, like, being able to sort of showcase where we're going and what we're doing in the future, because that's the unknown, that fan, even the diehard fans don't know what tomorrow holds, that you have that advanced knowledge, or you know a little bit of what those conversations are. And last thing, was so sure about that, Paul. This has just been so much fun, man. I want to touch on short form content and content in general, and how it's relating to brands these days. And I want to use this jumping off point, because we're seeing more and more of these, not necessarily micro dramas, but that's just one type of it, a way it's playing out, of these sort of not unbranded or very lightly branded, creative content, whether it's little mini shows or mini dramas or mini documentaries that you may or may not even see the actual brand featured or know who's creating it, but it creates this little bit of brand halo. Maybe you can insert some messaging into there, or some really light, subtle product touches, and eventually get these people to love your content, and eventually get them. I guess these are diverse, complex funnels, but, like, what's your perspective on this opportunity of creating, whatever, the next Roomies or Bowlmates or whatever it might be, around these kind of things that make people enjoy your content, even if it's not like a direct brand message?
Well, I think that's it. I think you've now got people that are willing to do this and create this. You build a brilliant brand. You build the advocates. You build the fans. They then are impact. Like I said before, they then want to do more for your business, and that's what you need to do. You know, not every single one of them is going to be a hit, but then you will find these smaller pieces of content that land, that are really there. So, to find them, you need to sort of give access. It's like you have to lose control and give more access to more people to the assets and the tools they need to generate this content. And I think that's it. You need to let them focus on generating it. They will create eventually there'll be eventual diamonds in that content that's created that will resonate. Now, if you lock off your brand, if you don't allow people access to kind of, I guess, assets or information, and you try and rigidly stop them using everything, realistically, you're never going to find those gold nuggets of incredible content that someone will create for you.
But
So it's
even the
like,
brands doing it themselves too, like even brands like creating their own little mini sitcoms, like that people don't even realize it's a brand, a piece of branded content. Like, is that ultimately like, are you see, is there success to be had there, or is this just a
yeah,
lot of
people
noise
want.
and a lot of vanity metrics?
I think once you've built fan base, you know, they want access, they want more information, and that's what I mean about really like doubling down on kind of the things that people can't find and people can't know. And I think that's it. Generating content that gives unique insights into spaces, nuances behind the scenes, you know, people connecting more with these people that they sort of admire, or these businesses that admire. It's like, it's fantastic. And that's it. And people want more and more and more of that. There's less focus on the kind of like big 90-minute football match, more the kind of like, you know, which are once or twice a week. And then people have these huge amounts of content. They want to fill those big gaps between the games, and they want to learn more, know more. And I think that's what people are seeking. And so the more your brand can create for that, to make these connections with people and give them a deeper understanding of your business and what you're trying to do, the better.
So you do want to lean into your business, your brand, and stuff that, or is it just like finding the whatever is tangentially relevant to your fan base? Like should we be thinking about creating like little mini, again, like little mini sitcoms about a two fans that go to a game and fall in love, and it has nothing to do with our team or anything, but it's a fun little fictional show that people can get into and enjoy, and you know, maybe if they look closely in our bio, they can see that this show is brought to you by this team or this league or whatever. Like, is that a sort of a format, both not just in sports but beyond, that you're seeing that has legs, that is here to stay? Or is it should it be more about like you're kind of alluding to, more just letting others do it for you, and not so much, you know, invested in yourself?
I think it's both. I think, as I say, I think people want, especially around sports, more access to different areas, and we're seeing that, right? Netflix now filled with different routes into kind of teams or Formula One, that they sort of give them a richer understanding around what they love, which is the main event. And I think that's it. People should be investing in those. And even like you're saying, even just the nuances of connections made outside of those things. You know, it's just people want to associate. They see these things as, it's a universe of things with the main event and the main club right at the center of it. There is so much that kind of circulates around that that people are interested in, and they want to sort of like, I don't know, find their parts of that universe that they connect with and interest them. And they all sort of come together and cure, I guess, in this kind of moment in the middle, which is the main event, match day. You know, everyone comes together for that, but then they all have different kind of lives and journeys with the club and the relationships around it, which is that smaller form content.
I really love ending on this point. Before I go off on a really big tangent here, when you said the word universe, I just started thinking about, you know, everyone thinks like the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's almost like, what is your brand's cinematic universe? Like, especially for a sports team, you can certainly have that. You have so many different tentacles that can come off of that. And so, like, building this cinematic universe that has a brand through line is, really compelling to me right now. And I can go another hour if we want
Yeah,
to.
I think you're right, and I think that's it. And I think if you think about that metaphor of the universe, it's like the stuff at the center is where you have to have the most control. And I think if you think about everything that's out it, you almost have to relinquish a bit of control the further it gets out. There'll be stuff right at the edges of those things which you have no control over, but we'll just have that small piece of brand building, which you're right, it might be just a piece of content created around the game, but it kind of circulates in this universe on the outskirts of it.
Yeah. Oh, I love this stuff, Paul. We're gonna have some phone Paul in our more version segment. First episode of Shareable Stat coming up right now. Just awesome stuff, being able to speak with Paul Stafford, the CEO of Further. Just really interesting insight into what goes into a brand, especially working with some of these huge legacy brands and also even the smaller and upstart emerging brands, about how you stand out in the space, how you are true to your customers, and how you create those North Stars that really guide everything. Something that we think about and talk about in the sports world and beyond, but being able to really put a formal documentation to it, being able to think about it in frameworks and really intelligent terms, a reason, a why for everything, just tremendous insight from Paul. But stick around because we're going to have some more fun with Paul with our quick hitting questions. I think my first episode's shareable stat. And this shareable stat comes from a recent study by Stagwell. Stagwell is a well-known agency in the marketing communications world and working with brands. And they also have a sports group now, a dedicated sports group at Stagwell. So a really interesting report or research they put together about sports fans. The stat I'm going to share with you guys today is about short clips versus full games. And the stat that they found from their research is 50% of sports fans, this is sports fans, not just overall adults or humans overall. It's 50% of their sports fans in their study prefer watching short clips, highlights, or behind-the-scenes moments compared to full games. So that means half of fans, that number goes up to 60% if you're looking at just the Gen Z sports fans. So 60% of Gen Z and half of sports fans prefer watching the short-form content over the full games. Half of the fans don't care about, I mean, let's say they don't care about watching the full games, but they prefer consuming that content otherwise, which is a really interesting insight to consider. I mean, yes, with the live game is still where the majority of the revenue comes from, those media rights. But the way that half your fans are preferring to consume your sport is happening through these other kinds of clips and certainly highlights and not caring about that live in the moment experience quite as much, which, to millennials and older fans like myself, that seems like almost like anathema. But when, especially for the bigger games where you can't imagine not watching it live or not watching the full game live. So really interesting to think about, and what does that mean for what we should take? What kind of takeaway should we have from that? Is the goal of the sports and social media to get you to tune into the live games? Is that something we think about as a main goal? Yes, we all think about and talk about, make sure to have tune in and make sure to include how to watch the game, what channel it's on, what streaming platform it's on, what time it starts, and all that, and using the pre-game stuff, whether it's the arrivals or warm-ups, as a way to sort of tease the game itself. But is that the goal of that content? Is that really, getting someone to try to, or should we even think about that as a marketing vehicle to try to drive tune in? Should driving tune in be a key goal? And if it is, should we be thinking more about it as an intentional goal and how we should be really optimizing the way we do that, whether it's through paid, organic, creator relationships, whatever it might be? Or should we really lean into the other aspect of saying, sometimes you're not going to watch the full game. We get that. So we're going to overserve you highlights. And yes, highlights are obviously already coming really quickly. If you're not watching the game, you can certainly consume the majority of the main content through highlights because those are clipped so quickly, so fast. Some of the how quickly the NFL and NBA and some of these leagues and teams get content out, get highlights out from the live game, from the full game is astounding. And so, the leagues and teams that are leaning into that aspect are tending to, not maybe they, it's not that they don't care about watching the full game, but certainly an interesting way to think about how we are marketing to these fans. And there's a generation of fans coming up now for which the full game is kind of secondary, as this stat really shows. So what's that going to mean about the objectives of our strategies? Does it mean we should try to create fans who don't care about watching the full game, who aren't going to tune into a full game? Or should we also tend to look at which games should we make sure we try to drive tune into or try to make sure that fans are tuning into? When it comes to selling tickets, oftentimes you might, let a Wednesday afternoon game or a Tuesday night game kind of fall by the wayside, and it is what it is. We're not going to throw bad marketing dollars to just get a few hundred more fans when we can throw those marketing dollars at a Friday night or a Saturday night game that with a marquee matchup that should be a sellout if we really put the marketing muscle into it. And so is that the way we should think about driving tune in for full games as well? I don't know, but certainly this stat is one to think about, one to ponder about. I will stop rambling now, but certainly an interesting shareable stat. Again, that this comes from Stagwell's National Research Group, and that is that 50% of sports fans prefer watching short clips, highlights, or behind the scenes moments over full games. 50% of fans. So super interesting stat. Think about it, ponder it, take action on it perhaps. But more importantly, stick around because more good stuff coming with Paul Stafford of Further. Right back in this episode of Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Paul Stafford. He is the CEO and co-founder of Further. Paul, you kicked ass in the interview. Are you now ready to give me some more versions?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Every creative person loves that term, like, version 54, final, really final this time, for real. Well, have some fun with these questions. Number one, this is gonna be a good one. I want to hear is, for whatever reason, the most memorable or extensive project that you've worked on in your career.
I think we've talked about two of the ones that are memorable. One, I think the Premier League, because it meant so much to me as a football fan and a sports fan, and my family and my son, you know, it's a we both Man United fans, and so we followed that, and so it means so much. And then I guess it's hard to pick one, but that'd be one because I moved to San Francisco for a year as part of that, and so, you know, working so closely with like these founders and the world I got introduced to, just hanging in those circles was incredible. So it's hard to pull the two apart, but I think that there's different versions for both of those.
How do you think the Premier League 2 has been embraced by Americans, by people like myself in the States? Like, is the Premier League's perception in the UK similar to how it is in the States from your perspective?
I think the only difference is, and this is a big part of the process, was that it's an institution, and it represents, I guess, England to a lot of people. You know, that's why we had to be very careful. You know, the lion itself is part of the three lions on the English badge, and so therefore, I think as an event, it's absolutely seen globally as like the pinnacle of football or soccer. That's the other big difference we'd call it. But there is that extra little element of it represents a pride, the national team as well in the UK and England. So the only difference, I think.
Now, it's interesting as so many, international football leagues try to win over the American audience. You see Bundesliga, Serie A, La Liga, and the different ways they try to approach, trying to win over Americans. I think ultimately the Premier League, I think, has come out on top in the States so far. The Bundesliga maybe a little bit behind in second place, but it's interesting to see. And for me, at least from my perspective, it's the Premier League is the elite football in the world. If you want to see the best soccer players in the world, you watch the Premier League, and that has is why I'm get up at 7 a.m. to watch games sometimes. Not 4 a.m. though. Those are too early for me.
Yeah, too much.
Number two for you, Paul. Tell me the new brand or rebrand that you and your companies did not work with that most impressed you or caught your eye, and why.
That's a tough one. There's always something. I mean, that I'm like, ah, that's a great piece of work. I think there's some amazing work coming out. I'll tell you what, there's actually one that, whether the answer was right, it was just the one I wanted to work on. We didn't get it, and that was the one that got away. I can't remember who won it in the end. It might have been Interbrand, but the Lego job. I mean, for me, in a world of creativity, getting to work on something that is the ultimate in the creative kind of like toy was one that I wish we got to work on. That would have been fun. But we, you know, it's so competitive, our kind of world, that you win some, you lose some.
Do you feel like the one that won one over Lego did a stellar job?
They did a
Like,
good job. They did a good job. They did a good job. Yeah. But it was always one that, like, man, if I could work on one, that'd be one I'd love to have worked on. It'd have been so much fun.
No, it's always interesting to keep an eye on what's happening in that space. I mean, we all lived through the short-lived Cracker Barrel fiasco, wherever you want to think
Yeah.
about it. That was certainly a big story in the States, and I think they learned their lesson to some degree. And you talked about, being able to not making sure that you don't piss off the people who have been fans of your brand for hundreds of years or decades or whatever. And that
Yeah,
was
but I told you that's the element they focus on, right? Was the visual, just the logo change. I mean,
totally.
strategically, that could have all kind of gone through comms wise, but that logo became the thing that you just people resonate with.
Oh man. Oh, number three for you, Paul. Tell me this is gonna be a good one. You've been doing this since from early on in your career. You've been thinking about the bigger picture of not just, doing the creative work, but doing all the business work, doing all the so tell me the biggest or most important lesson that stuck with you from that you've learned running your own business.
I think it's something I learned actually when I was trying to build the business, but also when I've worked with clients. And actually, there was a good point that I referenced earlier. I think you can almost, when you're trying to build something unique and special, you can listen too much. Like, everyone's an expert, and I think you recognize, and I have done this a few times, that if you listen to everything that people are going to tell you, you should be doing this, you should do this, this is what you should do as your next step, you just start creating what's already been made. And I think I've recognized that sometimes, yeah, you absolutely have to listen. There is gems within amazing kind of like experience and feedback. But sometimes if there's a real belief and it's heart over head, you've still got to buy in with it. And I think going back to, you know, as I talked about, and your listeners should look it up, when Leeds United or Cracker Barrel, you know, they probably listened so much to some part and not kind of really pushed with their heart forward, that actually it built something that reflected what they heard but didn't resonate. And so you do have to kind of like get a good balance of head and heart for me.
Yeah, I think a little tangent to that too is that we have to recognize that, yes, if a lot of people keep saying the same things over and over again, you're hearing the same thing over and over again, it's worth looking into. But ultimately, a lot of times, it's a very vocal minority on these front-facing social platforms. The people who are replying to your tweets, who are, commenting on your Instagram, it's maybe it's 1% at most of your audience, of your if even that. So it's important to balance those things of not listen, not respond to everything you hear, I guess.
Completely. And I think what does it actually tell someone? If you've made a big decision, you've gone through the right process, and you've made the change, and then you're going to go back, you're sort of really, you're just lost. And actually, that's what you're
Totally.
communicating.
Yeah. Next one for you, Paul. Tell me your favorite sports team growing up, and if it's different, your favorite sports team today, and maybe a little bonus of like how you would describe their brand, because I think it's fun for it to come from you.
Well, I mean, so my favorite team has always been Manchester United. I had a local team when I was growing up, Scunthorpe United, which, oh, a sad story. They're a team that sort of like, went all the way up to the championship in the English leagues, and then dropped very recently out and had some bad owners, right? That just
Oh
ruined the
man.
club and then dropped out of professional football, but they're climbing back up. But it's always really been like Manchester United, and I lived the glory days, and then I made my son become a Manchester United fan, and he's not lived a single glory day. But if you think about it, they are an amazing brand. And I think what it's a perfect example of why you should invest in brand. Like, what have Manchester United done? They've become a global brand that has probably the big one of the biggest fan bases in the sport.
Yeah.
And it's bought them time, right? So even though Manchester United have had, what, 12 years of pretty poor results, I still follow them. We all forgive them. They still got the biggest kind of following. And actually, there's always complaints on the BBC Sport website because the majority of stories are always about Manchester United, but that's because most people follow them. And that's really, well, it's certainly not because of how well they've been performing over the last decade, but because
Yeah.
they built huge followings, so I'm really focusing on building a global brand. And so the world still wants to know what Manchester United are doing, even when they're finishing 17th.
Great insight. Yeah, if you stop an average person in the streets of New York City and they don't really know much about global football, but you ask them who's the best team in the Premier League, they're probably just gonna say Manchester United, because that's the brand that's been
The
inculcated into
power of
them
the
over the
brand.
years. That's
Yeah.
all. Next one for you, Paul. Tell me your favorite city you've ever visited anywhere in the world. This is always a fun question to ask.
Yeah, I think I've got a few of this. I think so. Actually, I love Barcelona is one of the best cities. And again, it's not because of the football there, but and I think actually, if I think about it in the U.S., I'd probably say one of my favorite cities in the U.S. it's L.A. And I think you can't beat it when there's sunshine, there's incredible culture and like creativity and a beach. You can't
Oh,
like,
yeah.
get those things right. And I think that's what I love about Barcelona. There's the wine kind of around it. There's an amazing food. There's an amazing creative culture. There's the amazing sunshine and weather around the beach that's there. Like, what more could you want from a city? And I think when I think about LA, it's pretty similar, right?
Hell yeah. Yeah, Barcelona was definitely like my favorite European city that I visited, with all apologies to London. Sorry about that. Next one for you. This would be an interesting one for sure. Tell me your bold prediction or prognostication when it comes to the future of creative design. Like, it can be around the medium, the form factor, how AI is going to affect it. Is there something that you think that we should be keeping an eye on for the future?
Well, I think, as I said, we're in this era of AI. I think the challenge that everyone's going to face is that it's going to be much harder to cut through that noise. There's going to be so much stuff. I think, as I said, I think the term in one of the English dictionaries, they introduce words into the dictionary each year, and the term this year was AI slop. That's now become part of the vocabulary, right? And I think that's exactly what's happening. There is so much stuff. So it's going to become harder to cut through. So what I think is going to happen to maybe agencies is that they're going to utilize these tools. It's going to make it much quicker to generate stuff. And that doesn't mean terrible stuff. It can mean curated, brilliant stuff. But the value is going to be less about, I think, billing clients time and more billing clients for the artistry and the curation of the individuals that understand how to weave a narrative that can cut through that noise. And so I think what we're probably going to see is that I guess agencies, we'll stop talking about agencies as a whole, but actually more about the individuals within them that can craft these stories. And I think artists will go back to almost being artists, and that's going to be like the future currency of the agency. I could see it shifting to I need to work with this people who can craft that story rather than a business that can create this amount of content and stuff.
It's like the idea has never been more important. It's the execution's getting easier, or at least somewhat easier. But like anyone can now sit in front of an empty whiteboard, so to speak, or an empty cursor, or an empty interface with their Gemini or Perplexity or whatever, ChatGPT. But you have to have the idea of like, what do we do? And if you find the best agency with the best ideas, that's gonna really level the playing field now, I guess.
I think that's it. I think it's all about creators and influencers and people, and there will be within the agency set the ability to craft stories and curate amazing moments.
When you think about like standing out too from the crowd, from all the AI slop, like do you tend to like favor the novelty and shock and awe and polarization of like we have to do something that is unexpected or unusual or something that doesn't blend in intentionally, or it's just hey, let's just do the best of the best of what we do and trust that'll come out.
I don't think we should really focus on the output. I think everything that should be created should be like stand out, a moment that makes people stop and take notice. Or for fans to kind of like, if it's an event, it should be one that like fans want to show up at and be part of. But I do think, and this is why I think we're moving away slightly from performance marketing back into brand marketing, is that I think what it does need to do is have a connected narrative across each of these things that are created. I don't think we can just do something that's like a shock and awe over here that has no connection to the next thing, because I think we do need to build, like, as I say, point this back to that center of the universe every time. What does it mean? Why is it different? And why is it uniquely only this business that could have created that moment or that piece of content? And I think that's where it needs to happen. But everything should be, it has to be the most amazing, the most unbelievable, the biggest artist. But ultimately, it has to be based on a real purpose.
It's really, really smart, really well put. I really appreciate that answer. Next one for you, Paul, coming down the wire here, Paul Stafford, co-founder and CEO of Further. Tell me your secret weapon or product feature hack, something that like, however small it is, that just that helps you most in your job. Like, what's something that we should incorporate because it's your secret weapon.
My secret weapon, the business secret weapon, is this mine?
This can be your personal, whether it's a like a little feature like
What's
I
my
do this in
secret
my I do this
weapon?
in my inbox, or I'd use this feature in an Adobe Suite, or I this is my how I keep my day organized, whatever it might be. Like, what's a little hack that in your life?
If I was really honest, what is my superpower in certain situations is, and I have to be able to do this, it isn't really a tool or anything, it is just an ability to. Or a confidence, I guess, that I've sort of naively gained over time, to sort of recognize that to be successful and to do some successful work, I have to have alignment. And I've always had this ability to sort of go into the rooms, whether it is a small founder of a startup or the biggest CEO who comes with the biggest ego, and try and go like, have to stand up to them, confront them, and sort of go toe to toe. And I think it's that ability to, I guess, have the hard conversations with some of the biggest egos in the world. I've had to do it. But if you don't do that, you don't get that alignment, and you're going to build something that's wrong. So I think really, like, the superpower, and I've tried to kind of, I think the whole business has been good at this because I've backed them up to do it, is really standing up to some of those biggest people in the world and making sure that we kind of have the hard conversations to get them aligned around what we're trying to do.
Well, I'm sure it helps to have when you have success and credibility and a track record. You can say, hey, I know what I'm talking about because we've had success before. If you want to have success too, like you can trust me and listen to me, and have the confidence to be able to challenge ideas and put your ideas forth.
I think that's it. It's the ability to challenge. But it's not always easy, right? But you have to do it.
There we go. Don't be afraid to be bold, I guess. All right, next one for you, Paul. It's time for our food question. What's guys, our food question? Tell me if I come out there and visit you, what is the best meal to get in the sort of the greater London area, and where are we going to get it?
If you come to see me, well, then I'm not going to take you to. I mean, there's so amazing. I mean, this is the thing. There's always a bit of a horrible historical kind of version of what British food's like. But the best thing about London, especially, is the huge diversity and it's sort of like cultures. And so, actually, we get a really rich mixture of just like global foods. But you can get a lot of great foods where you are as well. So I'd want to kind of make sure it felt like a London experience. So look, we're going to have to go. There's nothing more British than the curry, right? Which is not British at all, but we've made it our national dish. So I'm just going to have to take you to either Dishoom for the high end or actually the grotty end of Brick Lane and take you on the experience of like we've adopted the curry as the English dish. We'd have to take you down that.
There we go. I will definitely take it. I love me some Indian food, and so it sounds good to me. All right, next before you, a couple more left here with Paul Stafford. Describe your creative process. Like, how do you get inspiration day to day? Like, what happens when you get sort of a block when you're trying to come up with like what is that brand answer? Or do you intentionally avoid consuming too much, or do you lean into consuming everything that's out there and get inspired? Like, just give me an idea of what your process looks like.
I think we touched on it earlier. I think it's so important to start with that we know nothing mentality and not just approach a challenge thinking that you've got all the answers. I think every challenge is the same, so start there. I think then it's about really becoming a sponge. I always tell the teams like it's okay to ask like stupid questions. In fact, it's like a toddler. It's fine to ask questions like a toddler because you want to, you don't understand something. As long as you're going to give smart answers later, like no one minds if you're asking dumb questions. So do that. Become a sponge. I think you've got to listen. We then have to make sure that we've got, like I just talked about, that alignment. We can't be kind of like hoping that things solve themselves and we just ignore them. It's like we have to be fully aligned about what this business is trying to do. And then ultimately, we have to get the businesses to be brave and buy into it. And I think that's what we're saying. You're going to get pushback. You're going to get people challenging you. You're going to get people asking why. If we believe this is right and this is what we're trying to say, stick with it and be brave. And I think that final thing is like I just said there, keep repeating that. Make sure everything points back to that proposition. Stick with this is what makes you special and this is your kind of role in the world. And make sure every single thing you create points back to it.
I love what you said too about like coming in like you're ignorant and have no knowledge at all with a complete blank slate, and taking that sort of like that 5-year-old's mindset of keep asking why. If you keep asking why, you're gonna get a lot of good insight and figuring out why things are the way they are, and when what you want to be, and it's just really good stuff there. All right, last one for you, Paul. This is I'm gonna put you on a pedestal. Tell us about one of Ferrer's most recent clients or projects that we should go check out now, or we should be aware of.
I think, I think there's a few that you should go and have a look at. And I talked about like expanding like the skill sets of what we can do. So I think like go look at the EA work on Further.group and just like that's been great. Helping like a business like EA kind of how do we move from being the games publisher into being someone that kind of owns all of sports entertainment. And that's been a fantastic journey. I think then in the sports space as well, go look at what a business we've brought in called Analog, like the most amazing VFX. They just did UFC at the Sphere. And it was the most incredible, like new tech and the challenges of actually having to create content for a platform like that is cool. And then I think another part of the business, Pixel Artworks, who make these most amazing immersive events and experiences. You know, I'm really proud because at New Year, they are part of like the kind of New Year celebrations that are kind of like broadcast across the world. And they kind of did this huge, amazing Hologuz thing on the Millennium Eye in London, which was played out across the nation while everyone toasted and brought in the new year. So look, there are three things that, like I said before, that our business shows up in the most amazing places and like
Seriously.
moments that really make modern culture. And they're three.
So cool, so gratifying. And I'll tell you too, like talk about a test of EA's brand when they severed ties with FIFA, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, are people gonna come back to and play EAFC because they trust EA more than they care about the FIFA brand? And so far it looks like EA is coming out pretty good in that battle.
Yeah, I was privy to some great conversations while that was going on, and could see the bet they were making, and they're smart guys and they understand it. And it's a little bit it reminded me of Premier League stepping away from Barclays. It was like, well, can EA step away from FIFA? And they proved they can.
Totally. Well, Paul, you knocked out your more versions. We are really, really happy with the final version. Now it's your chance to take over the podcast and tell us your all-star follow. It can be a newsletter, a blog, an Instagram follow, a TikTok, or whatever it is to tell who they are and why they're following.
Two people I talked about them. So after this, go and check out Douglas Aitken. He's the guy that did that the community. He's got a book out. He's amazing to read. If you want to work in a kind of like a sports team and understand how you engage a community, go and check out Douglas Aitken. And I think also just a good friend that used to work for us. He's an incredible guy. He left us. He worked at Pinterest. He went over to HelloFresh now, and he's always doing something interesting. And a guy called James Hurst, one of our ex-employees, amazing guy. Go and check him out. He's always doing some cool stuff.
Great shout-outs there. We will link them up. And how about you, Paul? Where can we find you, as well as all things Further across web, digital, social?
Yeah, I mean, I am just part of the Further. So, like, everything that's Further, all of my kind of insights, the posts, they all go through that. So check out Further.group, which is the website. And then we're on Instagram, we're on LinkedIn, look for kind of things. And we're always kind of posting out stuff and cool events to come along to as well. So just follow us on everything you can.
Check them out, read their stuff, look at their stuff that they do, just study their work. It's such good, awesome stuff. And we're really psyched to be able to learn from you. And thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing some of your wisdom today, Paul.
It was a pleasure. Great to meet you.
Thanks so much again to Paul Stafford, CEO of Further. I do recommend you check out their site, further.group, to see some of the work they do. And Paul is just a really smart, thoughtful, articulate guy, as you learned in today's episode. Just tremendous insight, really cool learning about their process, what goes into all of it. And it makes you think about these brands that are being developed, whether it's through expansion teams or new teams or rebrands of old teams, or even tweaking and bringing back retro brands. So much good information there. And now my wheels are going to be turning every time I see a new logo or a new team or a rebrand or anything under the sun. And thanks so much to Paul again for his time and expertise and on the podcast today. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for watching or listening. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horowitz. Hit me up on Twitter, NJ287. Also on LinkedIn, find me there. The website is dsmsports.net. And of course, you can find the podcast on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. Until next time, this is Neil Horowitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.